Greetings, everybody out there in Zooming land. This is Bruce Merrifield, and I'm happy to be with you for about 45 minutes to talk about the title you see there. For any of you who might not know who I am, first of all, my email address is just my name, which is bruce@merrifield.com, spelled M-E-R-R-I, field, F-I-E-L-D.com. And for more information on me and so forth, you can go to my website, which is merrifieldact2, not T-W-O, but just the number 2.com. And I'll make some references to that slide for backup stuff as we progress through. So on with the show here. The big theme here is I see this whole C-19 global pandemic as basically, in a way, a catalytic phenomenon. It's a crisis, but in addition, it's a catalyst for us to rethink how we do things. And so when you have to look at the world in a new way, that's called a paradigm shift. And then even as we come out of this to the new normal, it's not going to be a snapback fee. Everything's going to be awesome by the November elections. You know, I mean, there are people that wish that would be the case, but it's just not. And so as we go into this mess and we see our margin dollars collapsing, there are two sort of major ways we can try to downsize. One is by getting a chainsaw. You see Bucky the Beaver there. And basically, you know, we just, you know, if margins drop 10%, margin dollars to pay our bills, boom, we cut all our costs 10%. I mean all discretionary expenses, all investment in the future, you know, just across the board, trying to keep expenses in line with margin dollars, as opposed to the DUR, which stands for downsize, upgrade, refocus, renew, and ultimately reinvent, because you got a digital transformation you got to pull off between now and 2023, which is in 33 months. And for either plan, but let's assume you're doing the DUR, where you're saying, wait a minute, I know that within this sort of bloated financial creature that I am, I probably have losing customers and losing orders and losing this and inefficiencies, and not everybody on my payroll is, you know, the all-star MVP key kind of person. So if I had to just rank them by value, there's going to be a rank report. And so ideally, I know that there's sort of a ripped athlete hiding inside this sort of corporate bloat. How do I simultaneously downsize the waste while I get in touch with what's best about my business and most net profitable and increase the power and agility of that? So that's sort of the metaphor that I put on the other screen there, where you see, you know, Joe Palooka there with his big muscles. So just remember this acronym, downsize, upgrade, refocus, renew, and reinvent as we go through this. Now, I had, because of the digital transformation imperative that all people selling physical product stuff, thank you, Amazon, has taught the world to want to buy in a different, faster, 24/7, 365, you know, seamless, speedy, et cetera, way, and even at lower prices in many cases. So, you know, if we can give the customers what they want, then we're going to blunt what Amazon may do to us, but all more importantly, we're probably going to beat up on our lagging, you know, traditional competitors, both the distributors and the manufacturers. So that's what my 11 webinar series is all about. And you know, you can find it at under the e-commerce 2023 tab at my website. But that was all in the can and ready to be released around Valentine's Day. And then on Friday the 13th in March, boom, the whole world shut down. And we have this second paradigm shift upon us, which also is an accelerant, because we're all using Zoom and buying stuff online and so forth in a new habitual way over about 12 months where we're self-isolating. So this is going to actually, you know, be a catalyst to speed up the vision we may have of what we need to be doing in 33 months. Now, the way I see the whole global shutdown, which is a trite word, unprecedented, is you put the economy in a coma, but to sort of keep the body from dying, you've got to give it supplemental oxygen. So all the governments are borrowing money from our children, our grandchildren, and they're slathering it out there to sort of keep us spending money, or at least buying groceries. But because, you know, the money is going to go to who has the lobbyists, the big zombies are getting money. and they're going to, you know, survive. But meaning the bottom 50% of all businesses are 5, 6, 7, 8% of the, you know, business activity out there. They're basically going to close or consolidate. It's going to be a tough situation. And then when we come out of this, whatever we do, we're going to have additional burdens. You know, people still be germophobic and have a lot of fear. People have a lot of personal debt. Well, but more debt at every level: the city, the state, the government, et cetera. Pensions, you know, because their money was in the markets, they melted down. They're even more unfunded than they were before. All the people who were working weren't making Social Security contributions, which go to Washington, go right back out to baby boomers who are retiring in waves now. So this is not, there are going to be a lot of burdens. And I've looked at reopen economy plans from four different think tanks, from a libertarian one to sort of a middle of the road one to a socialistic, one. And basically, they all have a phase two, which is, all right, we can start to, quote, open up the economy, but we have to have testing out the wazoo of different types, and the tests have to be reliable, et cetera. And we just don't have that in the United States. And maybe, you know, you sort of say 50 states, you all figure it out. They're going to bottom up, do this, do that, whatever. It's, you know, they're not set up to do this. They're political organizations. They're not, you know, top-down autocratic, you know, fulfillment solution providers. And so, you know, that's a hurdle, but we're just going to, it's a huge known unknown. Gets me a little bit, frankly, perturbed, as you can feel in my voice. But you look at all these things, and basically the best average scenario I see is maybe by, you know, the fall, we could have about an 80% economic, you know, going thing. And even that will be compromised, inefficient because of precautions we have to be take. You take 20% out of our economy on a structural permanent basis or a semi-permanent basis, that is still a huge hit. So that's why you start to see more and more people backpedal and say, ooh, you know, we're going to come out of this pretty slowly. It's going to look more like an L as opposed to a sharp V back, you know, type of thing. But nobody knows, and that's why you have to have, at least down here, three different plans, ideally subscribing to the Durr philosophy. And the three plans would be, this is my optimistic plan, this is my likely plan, this is my worst case, and you need to be able to crank these down or up, you know, week by week by week, based on, you know, what kind of surprises out of left field happen. Because I think it's going to be Murphy's Law on steroids when you look at the global interconnectedness of what we're dealing with. Now, when I talk about three Durr plans, you know, I've already said, you know, you've got to be dynamically adjustable for best, worst, likely. To realize that what's going on now is unforecastable. I was amused when we looked at the second week of the shutdown, and economists, you know, we want certainty, we want answers. There are plenty of people saying, hey, you know, pay me, I'll give you an answer. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just going to give you a, you know, shoot from the hip, you know, cowboy economic kind of, you know, best guess. So the forecast for unemployment claims was from the 40 different economists from 1 million to 6 million. And the answer was 6.6 million. It's like, dudes, why even try? You don't know what you're doing. And they can't. So that's the world we're in. Then you throw in the wild card. So we've got autocratic, nationalistic, egomaniac leaders running China, Russia, Saudi Arabia, a lot of other smaller countries. We even have to sort of scratch our head and say, what is going to happen in November? I mean, you know, are we going to get a socialistic sweep and have the new deal? I don't know. It's unforecastable. So because hope isn't a strategy, we're going to have three different plans, and ideally we're going for that ripped athlete within. So downsizing the cost of business, the way we're going to do that is to realize we have customers that give us 100 orders a year, and they average $10 in margin per order, and we have an average cost per order for the whole friggin' business, the whole year, let's say $100. You know what? We're losing money on that guy. Who are they? Why are they doing what they're doing, and why do we let them do what we're doing? And let's go out there and figure out how to turn this. We're losing, you're winning, because we're giving a lot more cost-to-serve value than you're giving us in margin dollars. Bad trade. So, you know, let's work something out. No, I don't want to. I'm going to go paralyze your competitor. So whether they order half as often, twice as much, pay higher prices and unbundle freight and become profitable, or they leave and go somewhere else, we have freed up operational people activity slack. So you have a choice. you can lay that off, or you can reinvest it in your best customers and giving them and best target accounts and giving them a better service value proposition and getting more spend and so forth from them. So that's sort of your choice. But if we start to lay people off, we're going to be ranking and yanking, at least, you know, as we, you know, downsize our business. So statistically, we're going to have better customers giving us larger order sizes that are inherently profitable and better people taking care of them. So that's sort of the upgrade phenomenon. But by focusing our people on our very best customers and very best target accounts, we can take our service value to the next level and start to win more spend and or crack those accounts and or partner these guys on an integrated sole supply kind of basis. So that's the renew. And we have the first four letters, downsize, upgrade, refocus, renew. Now we got the profits, the confidence, the agility to sort of say, ooh, gee, about this digital transformation, reinvention thing, you know, whatever that is, let's go at it. Realize, of course, that C19 is an accelerant towards what we sort of envision for 2023. The chainsaw method, real quickly, is just basically, you know, I'm looking strictly through the financial lens. I don't have net profit analytics lens. It's complementary and very helpful. I'm just looking through one lens. So all I do is cut expenses proportionally, cut all discretionary expenses, all forward investments. And basically what I'm doing is I'm weakening my service capabilities across the board for best and crummiest customers alike. I'm still not differentiating. I'm just hustling every order. And then we tend to just, you know, we freak out and we just bear down and we do what we've always done. We just try to do it harder. So we're going to sell harder in the same old school way, as opposed to, wait a minute, the world's moving towards e-interactivity. And what's that look like from a selling model point of view? And then, of course, either school of thought, chainsaw or DIR, we're going to have, you know, partners who are going to say, hey, business stinks and I want to stick it to you. So, you know, I'm a customer. I need 10 off. Oh, well, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to be part of a win zero sum, you win, I lose proposition. But quid pro quo, you know, what's in it for me? How can we, as long as we're, you know, opening up how we do business together, why don't we rethink it together so that we can take out a lot of hidden costs in a win-win kind of way? And ideally, in theory, someday we might be like McDonald's doing business with the same distributor for 67 years. Nobody buys better, more efficiently, more effectively, et cetera, than a McDonald's franchise store. So we've got to be able to have the cost to serve, unbundle, sell it at 3PL. Okay, here's my land of cost. You tell me what you want to do, and here are all the little cost tickers and so forth. And we're going to create, you know, a customized sole supply solution that really works for you and your environment, whatever. So it would be nice to have that capability, but we can't even begin to think about it if we don't have the cost to serve elements to think and sell like a 3PL company does. So back to the typical distributor, he's just using financial numbers, which are an aggregation of all the activity. And, you know, if you could say, all right, you know, you have $10 million in sales at this profit center, and it was the combination of, pick a number, I don't know, 150,000 line item events and 75,000 orders. Each line item, if you had a cost to serve model, would have a profit equation, have a certain amount of margin dollars in it, a certain amount of cost to serve, and a certain amount of profit, or, you know, profits or losses. But if you added up the profit equation for all 150,000, you get your P&L. So it's your P&L is an ultimate rolled up, aggregated ball of wax to pay your taxes on time and borrow money from the bank. That's all it does. It's not about service value for your most net profitable customers. So the typical distributor in their bloated body is going to have about over 60% of their customers are break even or losers. 60% or more of their orders and line picks are losers. But the good news is 20% of your customers do generate about 150% of your profits. So they will pay for all the losers, and then what's left over is your operating profit. Why do you need three adjustable plans? Here's the latest from Arthur D. Little. And they're sort of saying, you know, they don't put odds on it, but they say, you know, here's, you know, some stuff that would happen if we had a V-shaped recovery, a U-shaped, a wavy W, or an L-shaped. So in theory, they've got four different scenarios. But this is all, conceptual abstract. You know, we don't, you know, we really don't know. So that's why you have to have a good best, three speeds, likely best case, worst case, and dynamically adjust them based on what sort of emerges over the next, month to month. Now, I would encourage you, as you are dealing with C-19 emergency issues, to be trifocal. So through the, and to use, when I talk about trifocals, like lenses. And so, at a bifocal level, to use a basketball analogy, if you and I were under our own basket that we defend, and we are going to inbound the ball and take it down the full court and try to score in the other basket, but their team has got their defense packed into, right there in our face. They're doing what's called a full court press. But somehow I fake the guy out and I get the ball to you. So the ball's in play. But two guys are immediately closing on you, defensemen, to try to steal the ball from you. You've got to make a decision right now. So through the short-sighted lens, the immediate lens, you're saying, what am I going to do to not lose the ball? I don't want to dribble out of bounds. I don't want to pass to a guy that's covered, whatever. But so you make a decision. And then if we tracked the path of the ball as it went down the court and maybe ultimately into the basket, you would see the zigzagging all around the court pattern. But every time there's a change of direction, the player that had the ball made a bifocal decision. They said, I've got to not lose the ball, but I've got to do it in a way that increases the odds I might get the ball towards and into the basket. Well, in this case, we need three different levels. We need right through the lens. We go, oh, my God, whack-a-mole, be a hero now, get there early, stay late. You got to do it. And we love doing it away. Our brains are wired to be a hero in the now because that's all there was for a zillion years of evolution. And we didn't worry about tomorrow and, long-term compounded interest, et cetera. It was like, tomorrow could be dead. In fact, is that a rustle in the bush? I'm running, because that statistically did better than the odds are it's not a tiger, but once in 1,000 times it is a tiger and you're dead. So you just run every time. So our minds get hyper-focused in the present. It's called tunneling. We don't want to do that. As you do your whack-a-mole hero stuff, you need to every once in a while just step back, take a deep breath and say, can I whack this next mole in a way that whacks the mole, but also is helping me move along my dir plans? And in the longer sighted lens, I've got to sort of say, is this going to help me also, potentially, get to where I want to be as far as my e-capabilities in 2023? So just sort of keep that in mind. And as far as the far-sighted lens, I will say just at a macro level, there are going to be at least three levels of model innovation change every distributor is going to have to do. Brands are going to create, they're going to go to your end users. They're going to go to your customers that you always knew and they were yours and whatever, and the brands didn't know who you really are selling and that was your big magic act you thought and whatever. Well, the brands are going to say, I'm getting on platforms, Amazon, for example, and I'm going to be all over and I'm going to have videos, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And as the end users are doing their personalized, random buying journeys, they may say, this is a great configurator and whatever, but now I'm lost in the weeds and I want to talk to somebody about making sense. You really think the brands are going to say, find a distributor nearest you and they'll help you out? That's not very seamless, is it? So 24/7, 365, they may have to staff that. So they're going to start to take away service value that you used to do, but they still need residually a lot of what you can or could do. So there will be a certain amount of disintermediation of what you've done historically, but there'll be re-intermediation too. And, there are residual reasons why distributors need to be there. So the channel model is going to be shaken up. It's going to have to be, to some degree, unwoven and rewoven. So rather than fighting this, you sell to distributors or screw you, channel retaliation, you need to go to your best brand and say, what are your omni-channel plans and how can I be part of that solution? Because if we work together and we make it happen, we're going to do better than the laggard, suppliers and distributors who, are basically fighting each other over this. So, channel models, customers that say, I'm under pressure, I need a deal. And you say, hey, what a deal. Let's go to, open book 3PL replenishment process solution. You've got to be able to dynamically give, a range of selling solutions as opposed to, no, There's just one way we do business. We have a field sales force, and they got their territories, and they do what they do, and we just basically, you know, sort of, you know, arm wrestle over the price per case, you know, type of thing. And then the third level is you're going to have multiple selling models, not just the traditional field sales FaceTime maximization model, but you're going to have different models, and each model you have to rebalance FaceTime with e-interactive team support, and that's going to be customized around the customer. It isn't around you and what you want to do. It's going to be around the customer. That's what digital selling is all about. You empower the end user, and if you don't, somebody else will, and you're going to lose because the customer wants what they want. Now, how do you do the DIR? The long answer is please go check out the overall outline for my webinar series at my website. Right now, there have been five that have done, and they're in the can, so you can watch those whenever you want, and all the rest will be rolled out by sort of mid-May. But to do all this stuff, you need, you know, sort of higher-level math. And it's a little bit like if you want to create the modern world, you want to be an engineer and you want to make all these bridges and cars and stuff that work, et cetera, you can't do it without calculus. And so if you're a math phobe and you want to be part of the, you know, modern world, I'm sorry, you're going to have to learn calculus and then get fluent with it and learn how to do it. It's the same with net profit analytics. If you have a net profit analytics, ideally with a cost to serve model at the line pick SKU level, then you can do all, you have all kinds of new insights and plays and things you can do. Now, because this is a new paradigm and it freaks out people and it violates old beliefs, you know, I've taken in my webinar approach sort of a psychological approach called appreciative inquiry, or in the book Switch, the clever authors call it bright spot management. So, for example, in this slide you see up here in the corner, if these are customers going from most profitable to least profitable, and up here is how much net profit I made on the account. I take my number one customer, I say that he made this much, and my number two made this, my number three, four, five, six, seven, eight. I'm going to get this kind of a curve, and this is all profit. Then I start to get to break even, and the little losers, and finally some big losers. If I turn it around and I said, I'm going to cumulatively take my number one customer and put the profit and stack my number two, three, four, then I get what's called a whale curve. And where the tail of the whale is, this is the operating profit. So these guys make all the profit to pay for the losers, and then this is what's left over. So when, you know, a distributor first looks at their customer profit rating report, they go right here and they go, there's no way that this huge account with a lot of sales, a lot of margin dollars, pretty good margin percent is losing money. Well, yeah, they got a trillion thousand small $2 picks and $4 orders, and you know, you got full-time trucks delivering nothing but small orders all over the place all day long. Your activity costs far exceed the margin dollars, so you lose money. But they are too, because you're sending them paper and their cost of their paper mill and so forth exceeds whatever. They got a lot of purchase orders. You deliver a lot of stuff on a regular basis, then the odds are they're out of it. And if they're out of it, then they've got downtime. Their people can't do what they need to do because they don't have what they need, and so they can't take care of their customers. So the good news is that a lot of these are there's sort of hidden lose-lose unnecessary activity costs that you can clean up, and you can both win, and you can convert. Literally, it's like alchemy. You literally can convert losers into grateful winners who give you more. But people still just don't even want to believe and look at that. So you go over here and say, okay, you know, by any measure, this guy is super profitable. We wouldn't want to lose him. Let's take him to the next level. Let's like have the whole team go through there and figure out ways to, you know, whatever, and look for more spend or whatever. And everybody likes to do that. Now, if I freeze headcount and I get some wins here, now we get busier and people want to hire more people. Oh, no, no, no. Now we have the courage and the profits to sort of say, how do we go over here and deal with some of these? But let's take baby steps. Let's go work with the little minnow who's just really killing us with tiny little orders. And if we lose them, we don't really care. Okay, we're getting confidence. So we start to move this way. So that's sort of the psychological drift that's built into my webinars. Along comes C9 pandemic. It was pandemic. I can't take baby steps. I got to take giant steps. I got to huge chunks. I got to do something radical here. So you still can do the DIR, but maybe on a more courageous, bold, radical kind of basis. So what I've done here is I've given you a little case study. I went and bought a business back in the 80s. It was a specialty hardware company. Here are the initial facts. They had 3,000 accounts, given only 7 million in sales. These are $82, $83, $84. And on a crude customer profitability rank report, about 40% of the customers generated 150% of the profits. So 60% of my customers were losers. Now, we've got a huge small customer, small order problem here. I mean, I just can smell it a mile away. If I rank the accounts by margin dollars, when I got down to the 120th account, they were only giving me $3,000, you know, a year in margin dollars. And actually, to have field salespeople call on an account and have a, quote, relationship. Let's say you have to have at least 10 calls a year so they know who I am and they like me and I like them and somehow they think I'm building their bottom line. Well, you know, it's $100 all in per call. And I want my selling field selling costs, which are expensive, you know, to run maybe 25% of my margin dollars. I would need $400 of margin from that customer each month to support a call each month. That would be 400 times 12. That'd be $4,800 in margin. So I was more, you know, lenient. I said I was going to go to 3,000. And if I had 40 accounts per territory, I wouldn't need 9 outside sales reps. So when I looked at the sales reps' territories and a customer profitability thing, they had just lots of little minnows they were assigned to because they're thinking whether I call them or not, I'm happy to take a commission if they should buy something. And, you know, they're on commission and they're not getting paid anything, but they weren't anything. They were weak reps. And so that's – I'm just telling you the stats, the facts. It's a sick company. It's losing money. It needs to be turned around. They had 10 warehouse guys who were getting paid about 85% of the average wage compensation package for warehouse workers in that metro marketplace. My vision was, I don't need 10 guys out here with a full-time babysitter and a full-time inspector. I need 5 guys who do it right the first time, and they self-manage, but they're industrial athletes, and they're cross-trained at everything because they're going to make 8 metrics of service excellence happen. It's going to be my new vision. I'll talk about that in a second. And I'm going to pay these guys like FedEx, UPS, FedEx, LP. I'm going to pay them 140% of the going wage. I'm going to steal the very best work ethic, thoroughbred race horses I can find. I'm going to pay them thoroughbred wages. And I'm going to make them, as a team, work so well, they're going to get effectively 200% output as far as GP per person, zero errors, 100% on-time delivery, things like that that are valuable. My back office is a total paper mill dealing with all these little orders from all these little customers, and the AR people were sort of dealing with $50, $80 slowpoke, you know, minnow kind of payments and so forth. And I needed a service manager to sort of invent ways to measure my new 8 service metrics. And I wanted in the inside sales, we had a bunch of, you know, very uncharming people that had a little bit of technical knowledge because of osmosis. They'd kind of been there and picked up the vocabulary of our product line or whatever. I said, I need superstar, can-do, creative people. And if we need a technical question, if I need one deep technical guy there, you know, they can use that person. So it was more of a specialization of labor opportunity. So those are the facts. And I did the big giant dir. I basically said, all right, I looked at the customer profitability ranking report, 5 out of the top 10, 20 out of the top 60 customers are a certain stripe of cat. This is our number one historic most profitable customer niche. So our first thing we're going to do is we're going to dominate this niche. And this niche is going to be personified by these 5 customers are our most net profitable customers in our number one net profitable niche. And I've identified 5, got my own my magic little criteria list, but I've identified 5 target accounts. I mean, these are the guys who want to say, hey, stop buying from those other guys and buy from us because we are going to have these 8 metrics that, you know, give you guaranteed uptime, productivity, lower your total procurement costs, whatever. If you're like, what is he talking about? But at any rate, by making, turning an abstraction into these 5 people and these 5 target accounts, and these are 8 numbers, we're going to figure out how to invent, you know, approximately is better than not at all, and we're going to get ever better. So quick and dirty, 2080, how do we start to get a grip on this? And we're going to really get this good, and we're going to go to work. I mean, for example, the warehouse, they were averaging about 70 screw-ups per 1,000 line items because they had such turnover out there. People didn't know what they were doing. Within about 3 weeks, they had a 10. But you say, these are screw-ups, that's the symptom, what are the root causes, how do we systematically change those to take those? And there's some quick, easy, big, you know, fixes to start moving towards basic service excellence. And all the people got this, and I had to do nonstop education about where we're going, why we're doing, everything else. I collapsed the sales force from 9 guys to 3 guys. So I took my 3 best guys. I gave them the 120 biggest, best accounts there right away, overnight. Their sales territory, a lot more sales, a lot more dollars. I put them on a salary plus, you know, operating profit delta improvement kind of thing. And but they were all happy because they got a little bit higher guaranteed wage anyway than what they were making before WO, but just the number two dot. One of them I turned into a telemarketer, so I had net 5 reduction of outside salespeople. So the telemarketer's job was to take 1,400 accounts, cycle through them, and see if they could come up with a sustainable, profitable territory of maybe 300 to 500. And the rest went to the minnows, and then these guys would go to the minnows over time. We sent every minnow right away a new letter of new terms, which would be profitable to us. And we tracked the order consolidation. And as the orders collapsed and the margin dollars that we lost from the guys that defected was just minimal. I mean, it was nothing. It was basically a lot of empty, small little activity costs. A lot of people were just ordering half as often, twice as much, and so forth. I laid off 3 guys in the warehouse. But when I laid those 3 guys off, instantly, right away, I went to the other 7 guys and said, I just laid off 30% of the warm bodies in the warehouse. They were not 30% of the net productivity. They were probably net negative. They didn't show up. If they did it, they didn't do anything. If you did it for them, that was great. But if they did it themselves, they screwed up. It's 3 times the cost of doing it right the first time. So I'm going to give you their wages. Tomorrow, everybody's a 30% raise to see if you don't miss these guys. And our vision is, will you be one of the 5 guys making 140%, so forth? I redeployed because I had less phone calls and paperwork. I took 2 inside sales guys, turned one into the service manager promotion, the guy into the total technical database kind of person, laid off 2 people in the back office. So net headcount went from 50 to 42, but there was big savings here with the 5 outside sales guys. So in 2 months, I went from losing money to making money. And 3 years later, I'm doing $24 million in sales, up from 7,000 active accounts with 5% operating profit. So instead of selling a little bit of something to everybody, and most of them being losers, thank you for your retail-sized order and my wholesale cost structure, I was selling everything to 1,000 biggest, best accounts who had a future, were growing, ambitious, et cetera, and really understood and bought my service excellence guaranteed. So that is an extreme, you know, dir turnaround. Now, the average guy would say, Bruce, that freaks me out so big time. It violates so many old beliefs, et cetera. I say, fine. That's why we're going to do bright spot management. That's where we're going to start very small. So if you watch webinar 11, my last one in the series, it's about change management. I say, look, you're going to create a little innovation cost center. You have one champion. I call him an entrepreneur. And that champion is not, we're not going to give the numbers to everybody and tell them what to do because they're going to be confused and scared and push back and whatever. And then we're going to basically look at all of our little plays we could do with net profit analytics. We're going to go to the biggest savings of activity costs with the least amount of perturbance. We're not going to bother anybody. And if we have to involve somebody, we have to find a best, most open-minded, progressive employee, assuming we have some. So we're going to sort of work across the bell-shaped curve of net profit analytics plays, and we're also going to work across the bell-shaped curve of open-minded progressive employees. And as we get a win with an employee, that's a value tale. It's like this, you know, here's the person, here's the story, this is where they're a hero, this is why they're going to make more money, whatever. And as you keep playing that back against the rest of the company, over time, you know, branch manager 6 say, wait a minute, I'm paying for, you know, I'm getting cost allocation from headquarters for this cost center and this entrepreneur. I want some of this love. And so the department's going to start to munch across the bell-shaped curve of open-minded and progressiveness at the company. Now, you're going to have to decide whether you want to, you know, do the baby step very rapidly, or you're going to say, you know, I need to get out my sword and do big chunks, you know, but dir-driven. So that's the story there. DIR also works for excess distributor metro capacity. So if we take, for example, the food service distribution channel, before the C-19 shutdown, the average American ate about 50% of their food spend at home and 50% of their food spend outside the home. Well, that's what food service distributors take care of. They feed restaurants, in-feeders, et cetera. And they're delivering huge cases and giant, you know, things of cans of soup and stuff. It's a different, you know, it's 1% overlap with the SKUs you'd see at a grocery store. So these guys, and then, you know, when we start to reopen, can you imagine social distancing as restaurants? The business model doesn't even work out. And, you know, people are still be germaphobes. We're all going to have new debt. I mean, I think it's going to be a while before we're out there just, you know, dropping $5 at Starbucks, you know, two times a day kind of thing. So right now in that channel, there's too much capacity in all the big metro marketplaces. So how does that consolidate in the most efficient, effective way? And so if you go read my blog 186, it's 400 words, pithy, provocative, whatever. It tells a story about how four distributors in Houston, Texas in 1972 became 10 distributors by 1981. Thank you, oil boom. But then there was a bust. And by 85, it was everybody was sucking wind. And a distributor called me up and said, you know, this is what's going on. We need to consolidate. So I encouraged the guy to send a letter to CEO counterparts of the other nine distributors and said, hey, there's too much capacity. It needs to be rationalized. I'm a buyer, I'm a seller, I'm a merger, depending on the math. And I gave them some crude net profit analytics, because the truth of the matter is, when four guys did in fact merge together, what they were doing is they were merging all their respective winning customers and the few key people that really controlled and made those accounts happy and whatever. They didn't worry about this. It's not that, you know, you wouldn't, you know, give these guys a shot. But the net of it all was is that they wound up having twice the volume as if they took all four, put them together in 85. 2 years later, they were twice as big in sales, making great money with a fraction of the people. So it's a creative way of saying, wait a minute, I don't want to go buy the whole bloated mat. I just want to buy the ripped athlete. So how do we put a value on that and an earn out over time? And then, you know, if there are assets to be bought, I mean, what's the fair market value for the inventory and so forth? So I encourage you to read that if you are in a channel where there's too much overnight capacity for a collapsed demand. As far as C19 being a catalyst for e-commerce 2023 and that vision and that digital transformation imperative, my first two webinars, which are in the can, you can go watch them whenever you want, number one and two, sort of talk about this. There are a lot of converging trends that add up to we need to basically do, you know, different model innovation at the channel level, at the replenishment system level, at the customer-centric e-selling level. But what's coming out of C19 is we're going to see, you know, we all stay home for 12 weeks. We're going to create new habits, and we're going to all get on our little phones and our computers, whatever, we're going to have all the little, you know, apps we need to, you know, download, use Zoom, GoToMeeting, WebEx, et cetera. And we're going to say, oh, you click on this button and that button. I mean, it's not that hard, but once you do it, you realize this is pretty cool. And I'm buying more and more stuff online, and that's actually working out pretty well. I'm going to go back in the real world and say, I'm going to, you know, yeah, I'd still want the milkman when I can go to the grocery store and buy the same stuff for half the price. So I think we're going to have a big shift as far as e-interactivity going on, which was going on anyway. This is just an accelerant. Is this a, and I quote Lennon here, there are decades when nothing happens, and there are weeks when decades happen. And what he's really saying is you are part of a big channel ecosystem. It's highly evolved. It's 100 years old or more or whatever. And, you know, we all do what we do because that's what we've always done. And we don't want to rock the boat because 95% of us are conformists and just want to get along, go along. And, hey, you know, the economy's good and we're all making money and that's great and so forth. But meanwhile, there are structural changes going on. They're creating tension, like two tectonic plates pushing up against each other. And finally, they slip and boom, you have an earthquake. So because the C19 comes along and it shakes everything, and it also inculcates sort of new habits over a 12 or more week period of time. And incidentally, during this time, Amazon is only getting stronger. They hired 100,000 people, now they're hiring another 75,000. They got a waiting list for groceries, et cetera. They're going to get into the delivery of kits and picking them up and Amazon Web Service. I mean, these guys are smart. And they are trifocal all the way. So they are not, they are continuing to innovate, and they got a, still got an army of people working on Amazon business. They're going to have to flesh out their infrastructure and their capabilities to keep stealing, poaching more and more business from traditional channels. So that's all there. And this is this 12 weeks is going to cause this huge shaking and therefore speed up the unweaving and reweaving. I may have alluded earlier to the fact that Milkmen basically collapsed as a business model from 64 to 68 for a lot of reasons. In the drug and grocery wholesale channel in the 80s, it collapsed and basically went from rocket roadsters nuking their territories, calling independent stores to, hey, you get married to us, you get married to somebody else. It became integrated, automated, you know, supply. There was a different selling interface. So, you know, you always need selling. You just, you know, it's going to be a different model. So I talk about those sort of forerunner channels and what we can learn from them, how we can adapt them and make them our own in our channels in webinar sessions 8 and 9. Summary thoughts. You know, basically this is, C-19 is a crisis, whack-a-mole, but be trifocal, but it's also a catalyst for faster e-commerce model changes. I'm suggesting rather than chainsawing that you get net profit analytics and you do three levels of, you know, or a giant leap of downsize, upgrade, you know, refocus, renew, and then reinvent. And how, as you create slack through, you know, activity consolidation and a little bit of defection from, you know, minimus, you know, margin dollar loss, you know, how fast you do this. And the ratio of what do I lay off as opposed to, no, they're good people, I want to keep them, and I'm going to put them on proactive refocus, renew, you know, duty and cracking target accounts. That's up to you in your context. And then, you know, one thing to be aware of is if you send me just, hey, Bruce, I'm interested, to my email, which is my name, bruce@merrifield.com, and say, I'm interested in your online interactive, you know, program, 12-week course to get a master's in net profit analytics. I'm going to work it on a prototype right now with some existing sort of clients, but it's hopefully something that'll evolve. Just, I'm just curious if there's any energy out there for it. You're welcome to go check out my 11 webinars at that big long link you see there. By the way, if you want slides, these slide deck, just say bruce@merrifield.com, send me your slides and I'll send you this slideshow. And then if you go to LinkedIn and search under my full name, D. Bruce Merrifield Jr., I put, you know, 3, 4, 5 curated posts with commentary about the whole C-19, the whole DER, e-commerce 2023. So it's a way of, you know, just getting to staying in touch that way. So that's all I've got for today. Thank you very much. Stay calm. Go get them.